Welcome to Book Waves. I'm Richard Walensky. My guest is Teju Cole, whose latest book is titled Every Day is for the Thief. Teju Cole is also the author of a novel, Open City. There are short stories that have been tweeted. There's one, Hafiz, which was tweeted as a short story. Several other works, including a piece called Small Fates, which I also want to talk about. He's also a photographer. He was born in the United States, moved to Nigeria, lived there till the age of 17, and then moved back. Let's start by talking a little bit about Every Day is for the Thief. I understand this book was actually published in 2007 in Nigeria, is that correct?
Yeah, it was by a Nigerian press called Cassava Republic Press. It's always been in print in Nigeria, but it wasn't published here until March 2014.
Why wasn't it published here, particularly since Open City had gotten such good reviews and had won awards?
Oh, it's just a question of timing. Timing, logistics. So, for example, Open City is available in Nigeria, but was not actually published there. But I think it just sort of also points to the complexity of contemporary publishing. I think 50 years ago, if a book had been published in Nigeria, but not in the U.S., then you just would not have heard about it at all. But because everything is so connected now in the social media and everything, many of the people I interact with had read Every Day is for the Thief, and many of them had heard of it, but had not had access to it.
Was it revised at all for this American edition?
Only slightly. I wanted to maintain the integrity of the original text and have it be the picture that I had set down at the time when I wrote the book 7 years ago. Maybe about 3 pages were added. Hardly anything at all was taken out that was not editing. The photos, there were photos in the original version, there are photos in the new version. The photos were changed, they were upgraded, but the photos are all by me.
Teju Cole, this particular book calls itself fiction, and I guess it is fiction in elements, but it's basically a travelogue about a man's visit back to Nigeria, lives in the United States, and what he sees, and most of what he sees and what he tells reads like nonfiction. I understand your next book that you're working on now is being called nonfiction. So why in 2007 did you decide to make this kind of fictional?
It's not kind of fictional, it is fictional. I mean, I think I understand what you mean. You're suggesting that it does not fit into the sort of conventional expectations of what a novel might look like in the current American publishing environment. That I understand. But I am interested in the form of the novel and in the forms that literature takes. And Open City is a little bit more conventionally a novel, but even that has caused some agitation because people found it a bit diaristic and a little bit fluid in its movements. And that's because I believe that a story can be conveyed by mood and by place and by having less of an emphasis on plot. The reason it's fiction is because lots and lots of the book is made up, but a lot of the backdrop in which these events happen are factually correct and they do read like reportage. But that's interesting to me. I mean, there's been a lot of writing done by people like everyone from Lydia Davis to Roberto Bolaño, J.M. Coetzee, who've written works that texturally feel very close to their non-fictional analogs. That kind of experiment interests me. Something that reads like a journal, but actually is not.
Let's take a specific example. Our protagonist goes into the National Museum. My guess is that what he sees, maybe the woman at the counter wasn't sleeping, I don't know, when you were there. But what he sees is what you saw, right?
Close enough. The difference is that the person who's doing the seeing is not me. In Ben Lerner's Leaving the Atocha Station, somebody goes into the Prado and sees certain things and reacts to them. I mean, people in novels are constantly going into actual art museums and seeing things that are actually there, but they're still works of fiction.
Well, is his reaction any different to the National Museum than yours?
Well, I mean, it depends on how one expresses these things. I mean, for sure, that for me, there's a kind of disappointment in those spaces because of the way they're handled and the way they're presented. But, you know, what makes a work of fiction is not if there are elements in it that are drawn from life. What makes a work of fiction is if there are elements in it that are intentionally made up, of which this book has many. This is the story of a place, and this is what makes it real. I mean, I think there's this myth that fiction writers just sort of sit down and create everything out of whole cloth. But it doesn't actually really work like that, you know? There's a Jhumpa Lahiri short story about a school group that goes out to the somewhere in New England to a cemetery and noticing all the old New England names of that cemetery. Of course it's fiction, but, you know, the cemetery exists, and this is precisely the way a school group would act in that space. Well, we don't for that reason say it's not fiction. I mean, I think maybe the challenge you're actually pointing at is the fact that it's not a question of what is made up and what's not made up. A lot of things that the narrator sees, he encounters, a lot of things that he expresses that I have made up. But what you're reacting to is the general form that the book takes, which is, it's very discursive, it's very essayistic in parts. But that's my fictional voice. And that's true of the books I've written, and that's true of a number of other authors whose work I admire.
Well, why then are you going for nonfiction for your next book?
Because that also interests me. The next book is going to be reportage and memoir history and more lyrical bits. And, you know, I have written a bit of nonfiction. I write for various magazines and newspapers. And that also interests me as well. In the words of Steve Biko, I write what I like.
Teju Cole, it seems to me that what's actually going on is that you're taking the forms and you're looking at the forms and you're stretching them in different directions. You're trying to find new ways to speak, if you want to put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an element of that in what I'm doing. I have written a lot online. You mentioned before we got on air about my series. It's called Small Fates. And when I was doing those stories, you know, it was quite interesting because a lot of the initial reaction to them, and even for quite a while, because I did them for, gosh, more than a couple of years, was that, oh, he's using Twitter as a way to present fiction. He has mastered fiction on Twitter. And I had to always say, these stories are not fiction. They're real. So it's almost like you can't win. As long as you're not sticking to the tried and tested formula, then it's going to be labeled whatever the opposite of what you call it is. So like those Small Fates I was doing, compressed news stories from Nigeria, people actually insisted that I was sitting down and making them up, even when I would say, well, here's the newspapers those stories come from. But, you know, breaking form and doing interesting things with it, it just really appeals to me. I mean, this is part of the reason that some musicians become classical musicians, because they want to interpret settled, formalized forms. And some become jazz musicians, because they're interested in improvisation and playing within form. And some people become experimental and avant-garde. I wouldn't exactly call myself avant-garde, but I definitely have an improvisatory instinct about the writing idea.
Photography is considered reportage, but of course photography, when you take certain pictures, of course it could be as, quote, fictional as a painting. In some sense, you're doing the same thing with prose.
Yeah, I mean, for example, if you set up a situation, a tableau with people in particular places, like if you're making an ad or if you're making a kind of pictorial photography, that photograph, unless you Photoshop it, is a record of a fact of the world. But then there becomes this further assumption that a fact of the world occurred spontaneously. And that's what we try to do in the best fiction. We try to present things that look as if they occurred spontaneously, even when we know that they don't. And it is only by going back and looking carefully at the structure of the thing that you know that there are parts of it that are too finely engineered to have actually been pulled out of life without alteration.
There's also the fact that, you know, over in Europe, they don't really care that much about those distinctions. Amos Oz, the Israeli novelist and writer, wrote a memoir, and a lot of the memoir was about his parents, grandparents, before he was born. And I said, is that fiction or nonfiction? And he said, let's say it's coming from my DNA, and I'm thinking, this is fiction.
Right. If we say something is nonfiction, that's almost like taking an oath. But yeah, outside of this country, if you say something is a story, it's a story. He's certainly writing from European antecedents. I don't think people were too entirely incensed by whether Shakespeare's Julius Caesar was historically factual, it's full of famous anachronisms, or whether, you know, Cervantes' Don Quixote was truly the story of a man's adventure out in the wider world, or something the other completely made up. They're sort of aware of the difference, but they're not obsessed with it. You're talking about A Tale of Love and Darkness?
Yeah.
Lovely book. And what you care about in a book like that is, how does it work as a piece of writing? I think the American literary market certainly functions in a different way. Like, oh, I really need fiction, right? Like, I don't go into the museum and say, I need some fictional painting or some non-fictional painting. Though clearly some paintings come from directly from life, and some paintings come from studio, and some come from the imagination. But that's not how we split them. We split them based on their time period. But literature, we split up based on if we think it's completely made up or not made up at all. But most things are somewhere in between.
Teju Cole, let's talk a little bit about Every Day is for the Thief. Now, you were going back and forth between Nigeria and the United States at the time. A lot of the book is, we'll call it, fictionalized versions of things that you saw, feelings you had. Mm. So on some level, it's a truthful Lagos, even if the story is fictional.
The Lagos that I've depicted in the book is pretty much traceable, except in one or two parts for some reasons where I have invented some details. But that Lagos is traceable. So if the narrator is made up and his family members are invented, the backdrop, the places, as well as some of the incidents, have real-life cognates.
The Danfo and public transportation. If you have money, you don't get on that, right?
That's right. And Lagos is a place that I like to say we don't have a hereditary class system in the UK, for example. They have impoverished aristocrats, people who are quote working class who are very wealthy. In Nigeria, class is money. If you have money, you're in the upper class. If you don't have money, you're down there. You know, nobody cares. You know what your lineage is. It does not matter. Yeah, the Danfo is not something you get on if you have the money to do otherwise.
The city itself, part of the city is an island, yes. And that's the wealthier part. Is that correct? Or
middle class? It tends to be. Yes, it tends to be the wealthier part of the city. It's just right on the southern part of the city. It's like those many cities that are involved with their water, where there's a part that is richer, and then you go through the bridges into the other parts of the city that might be less wealthy.
And the skyscrapers are not on the island, or are they on the island?
The skyscrapers, for the most part, are on the island. It's also the financial district. It's a little bit like the relationship of, I suppose, Hong Kong to mainland China.
When you go back, do you pretty much stay on the island? Do you tour in the poorer areas? What do you do?
I don't live on the island, never have.
Really?
Yeah, I live in the northern part of the city. Most of Lagos is not zoned, either for housing or for commercial use. So you have wealthy people's houses right next to pretty much middle-class neighborhoods. You have slums close by to industrial areas, to other people's homes, to commercial usage. My family lives, like the narrator of that book, in a neighborhood called Ojodu, which is in the northern part of the city, which is very, very much sort of mixed use. We can't afford to live on the island. I mean, that's a simple reason.
Is it in a compound surrounded by walls or anything? Or?
Yeah, like most middle-class homes. Most middle-class homes have a fence around them for security purposes.
And so the story of the house break-ins, if not nonfiction, is similar to stories that you have heard.
Unfortunately, Lagos is the kind of place that for most people who are middle-class and lived there in the 80s and 90s, the number of people who experienced house break-ins, close to 100%. And it was common to an absurd degree. So not at all a stretch to write that part of the narrative.
The story of bribery, there's a quote, because everyone takes a shortcut, nothing works.
Yeah. The way I feel is more complicated than that. I wanted this to be a story about somebody's sort of raw response to an environment that he actually cannot understand. Yes, I think we have a very bad problem with bribery in the country. For me personally, it's more about understanding the things that people feel they have to do than to survive in an environment that offers no other kind of support from them. You know, the narrator of this book, I sort of wrote him as sort of the brittle returnee who is infuriated that nothing works, but that's not really my feeling. My feeling when things don't work is sort of like a sorrow, you know? It makes life hard for the people who live there.
And that's why he is so delighted to see something like the Muson Center, whereas you'd be going, yeah, that's cool. You'd be going, well, there's other places too.
I mean, what I would say for this particular form of the narrative is that for people who don't know anything about Lagos, it's kind of like an immersive view of it with strong opinions. When I come out with a nonfiction about the book, I mean, I always have strong opinions in anything I write. You will see that there's a lot more back and forth and nuance and many more shades of gray if I'm writing something that is journalistic and more patient in that particular way. But I wanted this to be sort of like the handheld camera, cinema verite kind of feeling.
One more question about Every Day is for the Thief, and then I want to discuss some other issues. There's a scene where our protagonist goes to an internet cafe, and it seems as if like three-quarters of the people there are working the Nigerian scam. Now, of course, this is 2007, and yeah, things have changed because people don't buy the scam anymore. But at the time, was it that pervasive?
It was terrible, yeah. Not 2/3 of the people in the cafe, but enough of them were there and trying to hook in the fish. Maybe not quite so many, but there were certainly very many. But, you know, what should be said about them is that there are people in the society who think, oh, they're clever young guys and they're getting rich or they're hustlers. I think the majority of society actually frowns on them and looks down on them. And those of them who succeed, most fail, but those who succeed, they look down on for their ill-gotten wealth. I don't necessarily think that there's a great deal of sympathy for the genuine suffering of the people who get taken in by these scams. I think a lot of middle-class Nigerians or working-class Nigerians just think, well, if you're the kind of person who could be lured in by promise of free money, you deserve what's happened to you. And that's not really my view, but I also see where they're coming from. You know, so there's greed on all sides. There's a sense in which these scam artists, we call them the 419 fraudsters, because that's the section of the criminal code that deals with advance fee fraud. There's a way in which they succeed in part because the swindled also sort of have an idea of what they think Africa is. And the 419 guys are sort of aware of that. The swindled think, oh, it's from Africa, it's disorderly, there's all kinds of pots of money flowing around, I can help them out and make some money myself. If the people who were being swindled thought for themselves, like, these are complex modern economies that we're talking about here with all kinds of challenges in their society just like ours, they might not think it would be so easy.
Small Fates, which you mentioned before, consists of these tweets, but in fact there's a history of this sort of thing that you describe on your website, that
yes,
it actually goes back many years, these
yes,
kinds of observations. What brought you to that idea?
It was two things. It was getting on Twitter and seeing that, wow, short messages, this can be used artistically. I saw that right away. And in fact, I just gave a talk at Twitter headquarters and about some of the creative ways I've been using that site. I just thought, you know, if you have this thing that can very efficiently, in an almost an unmediated way, get sentences from one person's consciousness to another, well, why don't we do good sentences, something poetic, something vivid, something interesting? That was one, but before that, I had been a fan of the work of Félix Fénéon, who was a French journalist, art historian, and anarchist. So, you know, if the shoe fits. And he had written for the newspaper, Parisian newspaper, Le Matin, in 1906. What we would think of today as news of the weird. In French, they call faits divers. He was not the first person to write, you know, faits divers for a newspaper. They go back to Renaissance times, maybe to medieval times. Short news items that you don't have enough space to go into the whole story. Usually about disaster, tragedy, mayhem of some sort. But what he did was that he brought it to a state of kind of icy perfection, epigrammatic force. From the wires, from the police reports, he would just have these very neat, very tight deployments of this story. And so I brought three things together when I started doing, instead of calling them faits divers, I called them small fates. And what I brought together was the example of Fénéon, grim, darkly humorous, finely crafted. In his case, the book was translated into English only in the 90s, I think, as Novels in Three Lines. So it was Fénéon, it was Twitter and the kind of work it permitted, and it was an interest in Nigerian modernity, which a lot of my audience was not familiar with.
That was what was crossing my mind, that if you did the same thing in New York City or Chicago or Toronto, it would not have the same effect, certainly for people in the United States, as Nigeria.
Actually, it could have the same effect. And
you think?
And I'll tell you two things. One is that for several months, I did small fates about New York newspapers from 1912. And it worked very well. In fact, many of them sounded very similar to Fenians because the time period was similar. But many of them also sounded similar to the contemporary stuff I was doing with Nigerian newspapers. The problem with doing them with contemporary U.S. newspapers is that, A, it's a little bit close to home to be living in New York and doing stories about tragedies that happened in yesterday's newspaper in New York. That's one. Number two, our journalistic culture has changed just enough that most of the pungent details are now left out of the reports. The stories are still there. They're still interesting. But in the absence of names and addresses, there's little I can do with them. You know, I don't want to say, you know, an unknown man in the Bronx was attempting to milk a horse when it kicked him dead. In the old newspapers, they'll tell you who and when and where. And the Nigerian newspapers sometimes will even give the street address. You know, Mr. So-and-so returned from a business trip to find his wife in the arms of the neighbor. And the neighbor then jumped out of bed and, while still naked, stabbed Mr. So-and-so to death. You know, it will give you all the details. Those details are suppressed in American newspapers now. They weren't before.
Why did you end it a year ago?
Because I like to quit while I'm ahead.
I guess there's a certain point where they begin to blend into each other and you're going, I need to.
I wasn't at that point yet.
No?
People were enjoying them. It was actually at the peak of their popularity. They worked out really well, but I want to free myself to be creative in new ways on Twitter, which I then went on to do.
Which is the 7 tweets about drones?
I did 7 tweets about drones. I did 7 tweets about the white savior industrial complex for people who use Africa as a backdrop for their savior fantasies. I did a short story called Hafiz. I told an entire short story through retweets. It's a bit intricate the way I set it up, but basically I sent sentences from this entire story to different people. They tweeted them out, and then I retweeted them in the right sequence, so that the story magically came together as a series of retweets. I've done things with found text, and most recently, I did a 4,000-word essay about immigration and the Tucson sector and the border with Mexico. It was not simply an essay, it was a report. It was a nonfiction report based on 2 trips down to Tucson and over a dozen interviews about people dying in the desert while crossing into the United States. And I decided not to publish it in the conventional way, but to do it as a 250 tweets on a dedicated Twitter account with all the voices of the people I interviewed, all of them having their own Twitter account.
How many followers did you have?
135,000 as of this moment. And that is why I take the form seriously, because there are so many people who are reading. And I think that you take the work where the audience is and you give them the best that you can in that place. The same way if I stood up to give a lecture before an audience of 200 people or 500 people, I want to give them my best because I respect that space. So I have tended maybe to use Twitter in a more serious way than most people, but that's because I want all my work to be integrated. I want it all to be one thing and to all make sense together.
Have you ever considered putting these in a book?
The Twitter experiments, no. When I put something on Twitter that I've worked on, many of my tweets, especially in these projects, I take them through 12 drafts, the same way I would do with a piece of fiction or nonfiction that I'm publishing. I'm a writer and I'm obsessive about the craft of my work. But I don't say, oh, because it's ephemeral and it's on Twitter, I'm not going to work as much on it. I work on it very closely. But, you know, a tweet is a happening. People are there. They witness it together. You could say a tweet is ephemeral, but guess what? Books are ephemeral too. Even if books are not ephemeral, we are. So there are amazing jazz concerts featuring mind-blowing solos that happened in the 60s and 70s and that only exist in the memories of the people who were there. But they're part of the culture.
Teju Cole, I want to switch gears slightly and talk a little about Africa. You grew up 17 years in Nigeria. During that period, how was the politics and how did it affect you growing up? Did it affect you growing up?
So, yeah, Nigeria was my home and I had a pretty normal, pretty much happy childhood. My dad is a businessman in middle management. My mom was a French teacher in a high school. Central casting, middle class family. I went to school. My biggest worry was about just doing my homework on time and making sure I handed it in. Like many big cities, got stuck in traffic a lot on the way to school. Like many American families, our family had 2 cars and all of that. The Nigerian middle class is small but substantial because the population of the country is large. So it's a small percentage, but in absolute terms, fairly large number. But the country was also, you know, not a particularly rich country, and economy was mismanaged. So there were times of shortages. I remember a year when there was, you know, it was very hard to get bread. It was expensive to get bread. There's often gas shortages in an oil-rich country. Politically, the main feature I remember was every now and again there will be a military coup. The majority of those coups, interestingly enough, were not bloody. There was really never any time in my lifetime where I felt, oh, the country's just on the verge of breaking out into warfare. But we had a succession of military leaders. That wasn't nice. It wasn't pleasant to live in that kind of instability, and I think it didn't help the economy at all.
Was it sometimes, you know, you're coming home on your bicycle or something, and you come in the house, and Dad says, oh, by the way, there was another coup today. Maybe tomorrow you won't go to school, that sort of thing?
Yes, sort of like that, or we're going, you know, we're, everybody's in the family car, we're driving to church on Sunday, and then we run into roadblocks in the middle of the city, and the streets are bare, and then we turn back, and we come back home, lock the doors, and, you know, listen to the radio, and there's no regular programming. We're just hearing martial music, and then somebody comes up and says, I am General Sonny Abacha, and on behalf of myself and the National Military Council, we have taken over power. Do not be afraid, blah, blah, blah. You know, nobody's going to be persecuted. All these promises that they make kind of thing. And the coups were, I mean, I don't know how many I experienced. I experienced some that actually made the announcement and then the coup was foiled. And then those guys all went on the firing squad. So those were bloody. But maybe, gosh, I don't know. I can't actually say for sure now, but maybe about four or five over the course of my childhood. And there were always moments of actually relief and hope. Some fear, of course. New men with guns. But usually by the time the coup happened, we were tired of the old lot. But Nigeria is finally a democracy now. No more coups, knock on wood. But it is still a kleptocracy. The people at the top of government are still stealing loads of money, which is something the military leaders did.
How do you think about American coverage of African affairs and what we hear here?
There are two things to it. One is that you have very learned people, wonderful, dedicated professional journalists who try to get the story out. And I deeply admire, you know, the major American institutions that sort of do long-form pieces, you know, like, or just do very serious reportage, you know, like the New York Times, New Yorker, even the New York Review of Books. Journalist tradition is very strong here. However, I think there is a general attitude problem in the way Africa is covered, which is that people actually go in with their own notions of the kind of local color that they want. And I think very often they don't get the on-the-ground truth of what's going on. So then you sort of end up with cliches of the oil-rich country in the Niger Delta, which is with the Muslim North and the Christian South. And, you know, it's not like that. You know, it might be oil-rich, but it's also a country of, you know, banks and culture and a little bit of tourism, a lot of agriculture. Money is being made in other ways. There are states in Nigeria that have a higher, like Lagos, a higher internally generated revenue from commerce than from allocations from the state petroleum fund. You know, the Christian South, half of Yoruba land is Muslim. So things are not in easy binaries this way. And if you go in with your own concept, then you miss the actual story on the ground. And I always say that my problem has never been with negative portrayals of Africa. My problem is with inaccurate negativity. I don't like the whole Africa shining thing either. I don't want you calling it a dark continent or a bright continent, you know, just like you wouldn't call America dark or bright. It's just a complex place where different kinds of things happen. And what we actually need is that full complexity.
When I spoke with Dinao Mengistu, he was talking a little bit about, we were talking quite a bit about the legacy of colonialism and that the use of tribes, one against the other, is often used by corrupt governments to remain in power.
Yes, which is exactly a legacy of colonialism. I mean, we're talking about corruption. Nothing is more corrupt than using an entire territory that is not yours for your own wealth, which is what colonialism was. Colonialism designed countries for the explicit purpose of extracting resources from them. It's no surprise that those countries continue to be arenas of plunder. Wouldn't you say? for example, the United States is sort of a country that was sort of designed around this idea of liberty, escape from persecution, starting a new thing. Of course, it's also a country that's designed on sort of settler colonialism of a certain sort. But the foundational ideas on which the country tried to run itself were about freedom. And then that freedom, over time and through struggle, the franchise is extended more and more. Nigeria is designed for exploitation by the British Empire and has now had to find a way to climb out of that.
Do you think it is climbing?
Not very successfully yet. It's frustrating, but it's early days.
And that's how you feel when you go back.
I see a lot of things that are good and that are great. I mean, somebody says, oh, do you love Lagos? You hate it. And it's kind of a leading question because they want me to say, oh, you know, it's a love-hate relationship. And I think I surprise a little bit by saying, oh, I hate it. You know, they say, you're surprised. I hate it, but I love Lagosians. I love the people who are there. Some of the people I love most in the world live in Lagos. In terms of cities in the world, by any metric, it's a terrible place to live. No regular water supply, terrible electricity supply, bad roads, poor public services, high crime, but pretty shoddy built environment, poor infrastructure of 21 million people, polluted waters. I'm not going to be sentimental and say I love it. I was in Montreal. I, you know, love that. I mean, it's a bit too cold, but, you know, Sydney, pretty nice. San Francisco, there are cities that work pretty well. You know, but the people I love most in the world, many of them live in Lagos.
Tedru Cole, right now there's a new literature of the African diaspora, all of these people coming over to America from Africa and writing. Someone pointed out to me that most of them are Nigerians. Why is that, you know?
Binyavanga Wainania is Kenyan, as is Yvonne Owuor. And Noviolet Bulawayo is from Zimbabwe. And Taye Selassie is half Ghanaian. And that's only to stick with those people who are working in the Anglophone tradition, without mentioning Marie Ndiaye and all these other people. In other words, there are very many that are not Nigerian. But one in every four Africans is Nigerian. So I'm not sure we're overrepresented. It just so happens that there's a small handful of us who have some access to the systems of distribution and to the system of rewards that is present in the United States, who happen to be Nigerian. We're talking about three or four people, really. But there is a kind of diaspora African literature boom, or at least a boomlet. But what's often not visible is the fact that there are very many young Nigerians, very many young South Africans, young Kenyans, Zimbabweans, Senegalese, Ghanaians, who are writing, who see literature as viable now. So, for example, there's been a move towards taking over the online space. Lots of young people writing for all kinds of online journals in a way that even 15 years ago, contemporary conversation about Africa was dominated by American specialists in Africa, American critics, American academics, American journalists. And now the main discursive space for African affairs, it feels to me, is young African people who are online. They are on Twitter. And they have 1,001 blogs.
And for you, Tedru Cole, you always knew you would write, or did that come out of photography?
It came later. Photography and writing both started. I guess I'd been, in a way, training for them for a long time through my interests and through my certain habits of attention. But they both really came professionally into my life in the past decade. And before that, I was an art historian. And before that, I was going to be a doctor. But I dropped out of medical school.
Tedru Cole, you're working on this new project, this new book, a nonfiction book about life in Nigeria, Lagos contemporary book. How far into it are you?
Early days. I've made about 7 or 8 trips to Nigeria in as many years, so I have a lot of material on hand, but still early days in the writing of that book.
And the various Twitter accounts, if someone wants to follow you, what's the best way to go about it?
Oh, just follow me on Twitter, at Tedru Cole. When I have my brain waves, that's where it happens.
You've been listening to an interview with Tedru Cole, whose novel is titled Every Day is for the Thief. I'm Richard Walensky on Book Waves.